Hello, and thank you once again for tuning in to the Reptile Living Room. I am your host, as always, John F. Taylor, and today we are brought to you by Herpetoculture House eZine, the number one and only digital reptile magazine out there today. You can find us at herphousemag.com. And without further ado, we are talking with Luke Halstead in Canada today about changing the laws and how to go about things properly and what have you, and some of the work that he's done up there. So, once again, we are brought to you today by HerpHouseMag.com. That's Herpetoculture House eZine. And here is Luke Halstead from Canada.
So, today we're on the line with Luke Halstead from Canada, actually, one of our friends. And you probably even know Mark Ouellette from Little Big Rescue?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I used to do some veterinary work for his turtles, yeah.
Oh, very cool, very cool. So, yeah, you're our... Let's see, I think you're our third Canadian now that's been on the show so far. We don't talk to you guys enough up there. I swear we don't.
We're a bunch of reptile fanatics up here, to be frank. I mean, quite surprisingly, because of our climate.
Yeah, really? No kidding.
A lot of very hardcore, dedicated reptile hobbyists and professionals up here.
That's what I've seen. You know, and that's something that was interesting, too. You know, in case our listeners missed it, in the... last issue of Herpetoculture House eZine, Luke wrote a great article for us about changing the laws and, you know, basically how to do it properly. And before we get to that, Luke, let's talk to you about, you know, how did you get started in reptiles originally in the first place?
I was always fascinated with them, and I think the defining moment was... when I was in, I think, grade 7, so I was about, 11 years old, and my mom told me I couldn't get a snake. she let me have a couple of anoles for a science project and some tree frogs, and as soon as I moved out on my own, pretty much, as soon as I was in a position where I had a place where I could keep reptiles, I just dove headfirst right into it. I got my first snake at... Menagerie, which is an exotic pet shop in Toronto.
Okay.
And I remember reading this one book, the Ball Python Manual, and just being fascinated with the veterinary portion in the back mm-hmm. of the book, and that just got me kicked off on a lengthy fascination with reptilian veterinary medicine.
Right, right, and it's very obvious in your upcoming article in the next issue of Herpetoculture House eZine, where you actually basically write a real straight veterinary article, which was very impressive. Now, are you still going to school for veterinary sciences, or is that something you've completed already?
This is the funny part about it. I've been in the Army for about the last 10 years up here, and my high school marks were pretty lackluster when I was in high school. Everything that I have taught myself, I'm more or less exclusively self-taught. I'm at the point now where, in fact, just yesterday, I presented a seminar at the local animal hospital on care of the reptilian patient, which was pretty well received by the vets there, and I think they're talking about starting to use me as an expert consultant whenever they get a reptile patient. So.
Wow. I'm just blown away because what you said just coincided with everything that I've done. You know, I've only been doing this, you know, for just over 10 years now, but everything that I have is all self-taught. And like yourself, I've done talks for, you know, major organizations, and it still just floors me. That, you know, because you and I are a rarity. It seems like most people have gone to school and, you know, spent 20 years and, you know, out chasing reptiles or what have you. And it seems like that's everybody that's a herpetologist. You rarely see people that, you know, we just got into it because we thought they were cool. <You know? laughs> We didn't know you could make money doing this. Jeez.
Avenues are legitimate, definitely. If someone thinks the reptiles are cool and they want to go to school for them, that's fantastic.
Oh, totally.
And they should. And then some people aren't always in the position to be able to go to school for them. The one thing I don't like is when an educated person gets up on a relatively high horse because they have a piece of paper and another person does not. Whereas, you know... there can be gaps in knowledge for people that don't have a formal education.
Sure.
The people that do it really well can try to recognize where they have gaps of knowledge and try as hard as they can to fill those gaps. Because really, knowledge, education is a fancy way of saying that a person has knowledge. And you can get knowledge in a variety of ways, whether you go to school and get that documentation for it, or whether you just decide to be a geek like me and cancel your cable TV and sit around and read.
Gosh, that sounds so familiar. You know, and that's kind of interesting you bring that up too, because that happened in one of our discussions on one of the social networks, as we were talking about, you know, where, you know, basically the responsibility, and it all started from, you know, captive bred versus versus wild caught, you know, and someone, one of the, and I still, you know, she's one of the experts in the industry, Julie Bergman of Gecko Ranch, mentioned, you know, it's really interesting is a lot of people don't even know that there's journals out there, you know, because they see the Reptiles magazine and it's all flashy and cool, but then, you know, there's the scientific journals behind it, which, if you give it a chance, they're just as flashy and cool. It's just there's not a bunch of pictures in them. They're, you just actually have to read the darn thing to get the information out of it.
Well, absolutely. And you know, I find also that because they're scientific journals, they tend to be very technical and they turn a lot of people off.
Right.
Because some people don't have that background knowledge, or it doesn't really pertain to the general populace of the not-so-dedicated reptile keepers who just want to their latest ball python morph because they think it's cool.
But yeah.
For people that really want to get into the nitty-gritty of the natural history, husbandry, veterinary medicine of reptiles, you know, yeah, it's a mental, you know, it's a mental bag drive to sit through and try to make sense of all these articles without having that background education. But the more you become familiar with the terminology and the more you become familiar with the science, and the easier it becomes, and the learning becomes exponential at that point.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things, you know, in one of my interviews with Tom Crutchfield, you know, he made mention, and he didn't mention any names, but he said, you know, I've talked to a well-respected ball python breeder, and I asked him, you know, and this is Tom Crutchfield talking, he said, I asked this guy, you know, you don't even understand the natural history of ball pythons. And the guy's like, yeah, I do. He's like, okay, where do ball pythons come from? And he said, Africa. And he said, okay, where? And the guy didn't know. And he's breeding thousands and thousands of ball pythons. You know, and it's like, that just blows me away about how do people own something without knowing, you know, the natural history of it? It's like, that's just, that seems unreal to me. Have you run into the same thing up there in Canada?
Well, I mean, unfortunately. I mean, you can't expect everybody to be an expert. And you know,
oh, well, right.
People are at different stages of their learning. I mean, I was, you know, at one point when I started out, and I'm sure when you started out, you were sort of naive and didn't know that much about things. So,
right.
Like, I'm not going to put anyone down for being at a different, you know, a different part of the path.
No, no, definitely not. But
at the same time, it's that hunger to acquire knowledge that mm-hmm. sets people apart, I think. And yeah, there are a lot of people that unfortunately see the animal as a commodity that, oh, you know, if I can get a pattern morph now and breed it with another pattern morph, and I can make a quick buck.
Right.
Realizing that they're picking up juveniles who aren't going to be ready to breed healthily for a couple of years.
Right.
And by then, you know, with all the other people producing morphs, the value of them are going down. And
yeah,
we do see obviously a lot of circumstances like that. But for just as many people like that I see,
mm-hmm.
I see a lot of people who are very incredibly dedicated and knowledgeable.
Right.
So it's kind of, it's a give and take. And then there are some people that this is my least favorite type of person to deal with. Someone that thinks they know a lot more than they actually do. and that doesn't, that gets cocky and loses their humility and isn't open to learning or to people that may know more than them.
Right, right. And, you know, now speaking of people that are cocky and don't know that much. We have issues down here with certain organizations that are giving out misinformation to the general public at large, and therefore gaining a lot of funding and a pretty large foothold as far as legislation goes. And now, have you run into the same thing up there?
Oh, of course. Thankfully, this is again a bit of a give and take situation. Thankfully, mm-hmm. here in Ontario, in the province of Ontario, there are no real provincial laws regulating the keeping of exotic animals, and it appears to be staying that way for now.
Right.
Last session of Parliament, a member of Parliament tried to introduce a private member's bill to regulate exotics, but that, thankfully, they had an election and the government changed before that ended up happening. But these are pushed by the animal rights organizations and things like that. And unfortunately, it's not as easy. If I tried to go around door to door and demonize bunny rabbits to people,
right,
that wouldn't sell as easily as trying to demonize snakes. I mean, they're already demonized enough just because they're snakes or reptiles or things that we don't understand. And if you think about it from evolutionary terms, there is some evidence to suggest that we're programmed to be afraid of things like snakes.
Yeah, that's something we actually covered that with a couple of different scientific folks, a biologist, an anthropologist, I think two biologists actually, but yeah, we covered that in our Fear of Snakes series. And it was amazing to hear what they were saying. They're like you said, it's almost to the point where it is pre-programmed, but people can't overcome it.
Well, absolutely. But if you look at things like tests they've done with sensory memory,
right?
You flash two pictures in quick succession, two almost identical pictures in very quick succession, in front of a person's eyes. They're more likely to notice a change in one of those two pictures if that change involves a snake.
Yep.
So that kind of points to an evolutionary programming behind the fear. So with that kind of weight against it, it's very easy for these animal rights activists to forward their agendas with something that's already, that people are already afraid of.
Right.
And it's an ignorant fear in a lot of ways. There's these animals can provide so much to people's lives, There's research demonstrating that, the ownership of pets reduces stress. Even things like goldfish, they don't need to be a very cognitively, high cognitively functioning animal like a dog in
right.
order to provide a therapeutic satisfaction to someone with people with depression, the elderly, and where reptiles come into play is, what if someone has, pet dander allergies? And
right.
they can't have that dog, and they want something to nurture. You have someone living on their own. You have someone living with a disability who can't work. And these things have been proven to reduce depression, reduce stress, reduce blood pressure, reduce a whole host of other health problems. So, sure, that's one small segment of the population where, owning reptiles will benefit them. And there are many other segments of the population that can be benefited by reptiles. You just need to open your eyes.
Right, right. Now, talk to us a little bit about how you opened the Canadian eyes up there with your legislation, or bout with legislation, I should say.
Yeah, I take it. Have you read the paper that I sent yet? Or read through part of it?
Was that the last one?
The big one, my big research paper that I took 2 years compiling.
Yeah, I started reading through that.
Yeah, that's basically, so well, I wouldn't say I've changed the legislation. All I can say right now is that I'm trying. I'm trying very hard. It started off with, I wasn't going to walk into a town council meeting and give my opinion without having some research behind it, some data behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 2 years compiling a research paper that's all told, made it up to about 60 or 70 pages or something, with about almost 100 references from reputable organizations, you know, the CDC, Health Canada, the AVMA, all to support reptiles as pets. And the way that I like to try to counter the animal rights organizations' fight against exotics is by comparing the ownership of reptiles to comparing them to owning cats and dogs. Because I think even the most hardcore of animal rights activists would have a hard time trying to convince people that owning cats and dogs is a no-go. So basically, in the townships around here, in the township that I live in the Upper Ottawa Valley, they've banned reptiles completely. You cannot own a reptile. And the stupidity of these laws are that a leopard gecko carries just the same fine, just the same legal weight as owning a king cobra.
Wow. So,
really, there's no deterrent. If I'm going to have just the same penalty for a leopard gecko as I'm going to have for a king cobra, why not just keep, you know, the animal that I want to keep if I want to keep a king cobra?
Right.
So anyway, sorry, I kind of digressed a little bit there, but that's a bit of background. So I've compared the ownership of the risks of owning cats and dogs to the risks of owning reptiles. And if the township is trying to say that it's perfectly safe to own a cat or a dog or a horse to go horseback riding, but, you know, a boa constrictor is far too dangerous to be kept as a pet, well, they're completely delusional. And they're operating off pathological fear, and I would like to think, maybe I'm naive, but I would like to believe that my elected officials got there because they're at least somewhat intelligent, and
right,
that they're not going to be regressing into irrational, illogical, and pathological fear of these animals for no reason. And right now it's still up in the air. They've taken my research, they've read it, and my biggest obstacle right now, because this is a small community and we have one bylaw enforcement officer that deals with about two of the townships around here, and from what I hear, this is the guy that tabled most of this legislation, and this is the guy that council was listening to, this animal control officer, and he wrote these bylaws and tried to get them pushed through. And he's a guy that, let's just put it this way, he's a guy that not very many people like to deal with. Even when I was at the animal hospital yesterday, they don't like to deal with him. Other bylaw officers from neighboring townships don't like to deal with him. So for some reason, the town councilors here listen to him. I don't know why. But I had the pleasure of speaking with him on the phone the other day for the first time as he was preparing his report to council on the paper that I wrote, and I'm not too optimistic that he even read my paper, and I'm also not optimistic that it's going to convince him to change his position at all. So it'll be interesting to see what view council is going to take on this. But
wow,
when we do go to the committee meeting, I've organized a group of exotic keepers, and some of the other dedicated hobbyists in the area have organized a group of people that are going to show up, and we're talking, this is a fairly small township, so their committee meetings and their town council meetings have, you know, a few chairs in the back for people to sit in, and we're going to pack those chairs, we're going to pack that place, the standing room only, to show these councillors that this matters to a lot more people than they would expect. And hopefully, we're hoping that, you know, in a small township where they may have only won their seat by a few votes, that you know, physical support on the ground is going to be enough to convince them to change their position.
Right, right. Wow, that's just amazing. Now, so, now, do you breed anything personally, or...
I don't right now, just because I have a hard enough time. Well, not a hard enough time, but it's time consuming enough to manage what I manage. because in my township reptiles are illegal, I need to keep mine off site, so I can't keep them at my place.
Right.
I do manage the reptile collection at a private zoo about 45 minutes away, and that's where I keep my animals. So I get to tend to them about once a week. Plus managing the whole zoo collection. So that's time consuming to say the least, and I don't have the means to put in the amount of care that I would need to in order to breed something. That being said, I'm hopeful. I've got my male and female African bush, my Atheris chloracus together, and I'm hoping that they, you know, decide one day to breed and give me something, but that's about as close as I'm coming to making an attempt to breed anything.
Okay. Fair enough. So now, what does the future hold for yourself and the, I guess, just the whole reptile community at large there in Canada?
Well, you know, it's fairly up in the air, and it really depends on where the province of Ontario decides to go. Right now, Ontario is one of the last, if not the last, bastion in Canada where exotics can go relatively unregulated. The province decides to delegate that regulation down to municipalities and cities and townships and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not provincially or federally regulated here yet. So it's really one township to the next is going to have different laws. Some of them ban them outright, like where I am, and then a couple of townships over where the zoo is, there's absolutely no regulations, and I can keep my whole venomous collection there. So,
wow.
And I don't think, and I know there's been a lot of hysteria in the reptile community in the U.S. about regulation and bans and everything like that.
Right.
And the way I see it, and from the research I've conducted and everything like that, the conclusion that I come to is that having absolutely no regulations is almost as bad, if not worse, than having at least some regulations.
Right.
Because when you have absolutely no regulations, there's no accountability. The inexperienced keeper can go out and get their black mamba, get bitten and die, and then it becomes more fuel on the fire for the animal rights people.
Right.
And you know, I think the way that Florida does it, the way that the UK does it, these are good systems. And I know that there's, you know, I might be rocking the boat a little bit as far as the people in the States that don't want any regulation at all, that want the government to stay out of their lives. And I get that. But at the end of the day, I think we're going to have to capitulate to some regulation where at least qualified people that can prove they're qualified, people that are dedicated enough to actually go through the process of, you know, having their facility inspected and getting a license, can own whatever animals they want. And the way I see it, you know, the only difference between a secure enclosure at a zoo and a secure enclosure on private property, if both of them are managed well, the only difference is that one's displayed to the public and the other one isn't. And as long as you have that accountability and the incentive to remain accountable. You know, if someone has to work hard and pay yearly fees to get a license, and if their license gets yanked, their whole collection gets pulled, confiscated. That's incentive to maintain proper husbandry, to do things safely, to not have any accidents. When you have no regulation, you have no incentive, and then accidents happen. And when accidents happen, then blanket bans get established.
Right.
When blanket bans get established, nobody's happy.
Right, and that's something that a few of my colleagues and myself are working on, is trying to get people to understand that, okay, you know, if, you know, we've got to be responsible first. You know, if you keep your, you know, animals in improper enclosures and they get out and kill, you know, even another animal that someone values, you know, such as a dog or a pet cat or what have you, much less a child in your own home.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, that's that guy's responsibility, but it blankets everybody. That they don't have a choice. They can't just, you know, I mean, it's really difficult to get people to understand here in the States, and I'm sure up there too, that, you know, yes, everybody's actions in the community reflect on everybody else's.
Absolutely. And you know, I think that's, like I mentioned in my article in the last issue of Herpeticulture House e-zine that I did for you there,
mm-hmm.
I think one of the biggest problems with the reptile community as a community is that we don't really have a community.
No.
We don't have that... We have a collection of individuals, or so it seems anyway. Discounting the few very dedicated people, the large bulk of actual reptile owners,
mm-hmm.
don't get involved.
No.
And we need to get involved. We need to band together and make ourselves a voice that the politicians are going to listen to.
Right.
And until we do that, until we, you know, stop fighting legislation in dribs and drabs and without any kind of serious organizational objectives.
Right.
Unfortunately, I think we're going to be fighting a losing battle until you know, the Department of Natural Resources is knocking on your door to confiscate your reptiles.
Right, right. You know, and one of the biggest things, too, that you and I have spoken about, I believe, or emailed back and forth is, you know, getting involved in reptile societies, you know, herpetological societies, reptile societies, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Just, you know, going out and meeting with other people that are involved in reptiles. I took a survey of my audience members a while back, and 67% of the people that took the survey were not involved in a reptile club or society of some kind.
Well, and that doesn't surprise me at all.
Really? Wow.
Because it's fairly consistent up here. But I think the thing that people need to remember is that, you know, a force for political lobby doesn't have to be the boring, dry, you know, thing where you just talk about politics. The primary objective of any, you know, reptile club, herp club, or anything should be, you know, meeting people in the community, having fun, showing off
yeah.
interesting, exciting animals.
Right.
You know, an ability to show off your collection and see other people's and exchange ideas. You know, these things are... We do these anyway on online forums.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the problem with driving half an hour or an hour for, you know, on a Saturday to meet people that you know you're going to get along with?
Yeah.
And to see animals that you know you want to see. And the political lobby can be secondary. You know,
right.
Unless you've got that group of people together in one room having a good time, and you've done that consistently over a period of months, and then you can start, you know, picking a group of people to go and fight a lobbying battle.
Right, right.
And communicating with other groups and getting some kind of a unified grassroots force. I mean, if there's one thing that has been proven in the world in the last few years, is that grassroots movements work.
Yeah, they do.
And if they have a bottom-up structure instead of a top-down structure, and a lot of, you know, cross-communication with different reptile groups and different groups of dedicated people who care about the hobby, we could be a force to be reckoned with. But we just need to have... We don't need to be, you know, super organized. We just need some level of organization
right.
that's enough to get a big group of people in one place at one time.
Yeah, exactly. No, I couldn't agree more. Wow. I think I might just move to Canada.
our problems are similar to yours. Except for the healthcare thing. If I get bitten by my hot stuff, I know I won't be landed with a huge bill, but
yeah, really, really. So, now, just in closing here, Luke, what would you recommend for maybe, I don't want to say the older keeper, but I guess what would you recommend for, you know, understanding that you're in Canada and we're in the U.S., that, the you know, legislation is different, but, you know, I think Luke's brought up some excellent points of the grassroots, you know, movements and things like that. So where would you say to start, you know, if you were here in our shoes right now, what would be the first couple of steps that you would take to, you know, get stuff handled or get it organized or something?
Well, you know, you said points. You started off on saying, you know, points for the older, more experienced keepers. And what immediately comes to mind is, you know, what I've been exposed to for almost as long as I've been into reptiles is the Army, right?
Yeah.
And the more senior people, the people who know more, who've done more, who've lived the life more, are expected to be leaders, and they're expected to show leadership. And what I've seen a lot with some more sort of experienced keepers is there's the little clique. There's the old boys club of the experienced guys that kind of, you know, don't want to hear anything from or talk to, you know, the brand new keeper because they're on different levels. I get that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're in a situation right now where we need leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to see leadership from the more experienced people in the community and to bring new keepers into the fold, to get people engaged. You know, if there's one power that the experienced keepers have, is that the new keepers will listen to them. And people will follow a leader. It's human nature.
Right.
And when we're talking about, you know, fighting for a hobby that we care about, that everyone cares about, the new keepers and the old keepers alike, we all care and we all love doing what we do and we love our animals. You know, this image that the animal rights paints of you know, animals being mistreated, you know, that's largely not what I see in this community.
Right.
And when there are people that that fit into that category, they tend to be pretty quickly sorted out by people that know what they're doing.
Right. Right.
And we need leadership.
Right.
We need the experienced keeper to bring the new keepers into the fold and to just get everyone engaged.
Yeah, basically somebody pick up the reins and just make it happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not as individuals, but as groups of leaders, as
right.
groups of people with the same objective.
Very good. Very cool.
Yeah, well, it's I hope it happens. I hope it happens here, and I definitely hope it happens down there, because the laws that are being proposed down in the States are a lot more imminent and a lot scarier than the laws up here.
Yeah, it's really crazy, but, you know, like I said, we have a couple of groups that are coming together and organizing and stuff like that, so I'm supporting everyone as much as I can, you know, but it's really tough, you know, because a lot of groups and a lot of people want to, instead of organizing, they want to, you know, talk about this group or that group not doing this or that. It's like, really? You guys are going to waste your breath talking about each other and not come together and be just one giant community that might actually make something happen. You know, and that's the thing with the personality conflicts and stuff like that. That's what just kills me every time I see it.
And you hit the nail on the head there. We're at all hands on deck time, and we need to drop the egos and go with it. Because if people are gonna be, you know, egotistical, you know, my group is better than yours or
yeah.
And we, you know, this kind of infighting is,
it's fuel, you know, for the fire.
it's fuel. It's not only is it fuel for the fire, but it's feeding right into the hands of everyone who would work to destroy our hobby.
Yeah.
And not only that, and one point that I think is very important to mention,
mm-hmm.
and I touch on it a little bit in my paper, is that as an exotic keeping community, we can't ostracize, you know, we keep reptiles, but, you know, the community can't ostracize the venomous reptile keepers, and the keepers can't ostracize the people that want to keep a lion or a tiger, provided that they're doing it responsibly and in a way that is not harmful or stressful to the animal.
Right.
You know, it's not about responsible reptile ownership or responsible big cat ownership. It's about responsible exotic animal ownership, and
right.
really, at the end of the day, responsible animal ownership.
Right.
And if that's our primary objective, and all the people that, you know, in the U.S. and in Canada that keep exotic animals were to band together instead of pointing fingers at each other and infighting and letting egos get in the way, we'd be getting a lot further than we have. We'd
mm-hmm.
be, you know, a force right up alongside PETA and all of them. So I just, someone needs to make it happen, you know. So we as a community need to reach out to other communities, or you know, one herp club needs to reach out to another herp club, and we need to, you know, band together as this grassroots movement in order
right.
for us to get anywhere.
Right. Now, and something I want my listeners to pay close attention to, you know, we hear in Luke talking about, you know, someone needs to do something, and just for those who missed the entire first half of the conversation, Luke has done something and is doing something. Because I know somebody's going to pick up on that and be like, well, what did he do? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Pick up a... You know what? Actually, email me personally, and I'll send you a copy of Prophetic Ultra House so you can see what Luke has been doing. So I just want to make sure that's pointed out and very clear in this interview that, you know, you're out there, you've stood in front of the government offices that need to be stood in front of, and given your say and your feedback, and just... Now, have you issued them that... You did issue that report, correct?
Absolutely, I did, and I've issued it to one township. And like, let's put it this way: I'm not saying, you know, someone do something, throwing my hands up in the air. I'm not done yet. I'm still
right. Very true.
This is going to continue. Actually, the provincial member of parliament who tabled that private members legislation last term of parliament,
mm-hmm.
He's planning to do it again this term of parliament. And I've been able to speak with his aide, and hopefully end up getting some FaceTime with him to be able to at least show him my paper and discuss with him some of the concerns. So if this does get to the provincial level again, which hopefully I'll have some, you know, a few months notice on to organize or to help start to organize a bigger group of people in protest,
mm-hmm.
that we can do this. But no, I'm not done. And I'm in this for the long haul, and this is going to be a long fight. And
right.
I have a lot on my plate in my life, but I will always have time for this.
You know, and that's something else too. You mentioned the word protest. Now, that's something else that I want to mention about Luke as well, is he's not going into the provincial offices screaming like a banshee, cussing like a drunken sailor. He's doing it on a professional level. Now, Luke, can you give us some background on, you know, because I know you guys have them up there too, because we do. These guys that want to stand up on the pedestal and curse and scream and, you know, and it doesn't get them anywhere, but, you know, maybe, you know, you have some more insight on how to handle yourself professionally in the media and community.
You know, and I think out of all the keepers, the exotic animal keeping community, the reptile community does tend to carry the stereotype of the, you know, heavily tattooed, loudmouthed type of people. And sure, there is some of that, and I know a lot of great people that are like that.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, that's not going to, you know, standing up and swearing and screaming isn't going to further our objective. Sure, it might make you feel better to get that rage off your chest. And believe me, I would love to be able to just scream out, you know, grab some of these politicians by the shirt and scream in their face. But, you know, that's not going to get anything done. That's not going to further our objectives. That's not going to accomplish anything.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a time and a place for protest. And the reason that I spent 2 years writing up a paper that puts out a fairly linear, or very linear, logical argument and a very, very, you know, clear representation of the actual risk to keeping reptiles, and even some of the ways to manage those risks and preserve freedom and public safety in the case of, you know, large or venomous reptiles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you can present that logical argument to someone and they still say no, then you have a much more sturdy soapbox to stand on when you do get up and protest.
Right.
Because we've already got Plan B organized for... If this plan doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
and they vote no on this, we've got about you know, 100 person group gathered, and when the weather gets warmer, we're going to do a reptile march straight down to City Hall.
Wow!
Everyone bringing their illegal corn snakes and bearded dragons and everything like that out. We're going to stand there in front of City Hall, and in a small community, 100 people doing that is a force to be reckoned with. And we've already had some media attention, and that, I'm sure, will get more media attention. And if we're getting the kind of media attention at that stage where we can say, look, we put a very logical argument forward,
mm-hmm.
you know, these things are safe, you see them out here, there's 100 of us, these animals aren't hurting anybody, why are they illegal?
Right.
And you can you can run it the way Gandhi ran it when he was protesting the British. You know, any law that's not worth following shouldn't be followed. And if they are going to use force to, you know, remove our reptiles and fine everyone, then they're the bad guys, not us.
Yep.
And when that gets enough attention, and that starts making bad press for the people responsible, then things are going to start to change.
I couldn't agree more.
it's just all about, you know, it's just about thinking a few steps ahead.
Right,
and
right.
You know, not every plan is going to work, and you're gonna run into roadblocks and mistakes along the way. And the key is perseverance. You know, you look at any kind of protest of you know any kind of political protest or anything like that. If you know, you look at the civil rights movement in the 60s. If the people just showed up for one rally and then called it a day, nothing would have ever happened.
Yeah.
So anyone really interested in changing these laws, or anyone listening to this program that thinks, oh yeah, you know, I'd like to fight the Python ban or something like that,
right,
needs to recognize that this isn't going to be, you know, you show up to one rally and you feel really good about yourself and you go home and said, I did my part. No, you need to continue fighting. Yeah. And we need to continue showing numbers until the problem is resolved.
Right.
And that's the only way that anything like this is going to work.
Very definitely. I don't think I could add anything better to that, to be honest, Luke.
I'll keep you updated on, as to how it goes.
Yeah, very definitely do that.
So there you have it, folks. That was Luke Halstead from Canada talking about regulation and what we can do to fight the regulation that's currently coming down the pipe as far as the U.S., Canada, as far as really worldwide is concerned. You know, there's a lot of regulations out there. We can either stand up together and take a fight at it, or, you know, we can go our separate ways and, you know, hope for the best. But it's all up to us to become one community instead of several small communities all fighting for the same thing and not really achieving anything. So, please do log in to herphousemag.com, become a subscriber, buy an issue, buy a single issue, buy a subscription, buy the annual. Help support us. Leave some comments in the comments field on the show notes, and tell us what you think of the show. We'd love to hear from you. And once again, I'm your host, as always, John F. Taylor, and this is the Reptile Living Room, and we look forward to seeing you next week in the Reptile Living Room with our next guest.